Hello and welcome to The Shape of Work, a podcast series by SpringWorks. My name is Anoop and I am your host. Each week, we'll be talking to top people managers across the world on the future of work and how it's shaping our workplace. So sit back and get ready to find out more from these movers and shakers as we have a no-holds-barred, anything-goes conversation with them about their journey, their insights, their thoughts, and most importantly, their ideas and vision for the workplace of the future. Join in on the conversation, leave a comment, and don't forget to hit that subscribe button.
On this episode of the Shape of Work podcast, our guest is Jayant Rastogi, Global CEO of Magic Plus India Foundation, an NGO founded 20 years ago, which has made a difference by working in the poorest communities to help 1 million children and young people transform their lives. Jayant is an industry veteran with over 28 years of experience in setting up and driving successful and scalable businesses. An entrepreneur for the last 3 years, Jayant has diverse experiences working in the tech, distribution and enterprise segment. In this episode, he talks about his journey from being part of several tech-based enterprises to now working in the social sector. We picked his brain to know about the importance of strong communication, maintaining a culture that motivates team members, and implementation of technology and automation in the social sector.
Welcome to another episode of the Shape of Work podcast. Joining me today is Jayant Rastogi, Global CEO at Magic Bus India Foundation. Jayant, thank you so much for giving us your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Jayant, you worked with corporations like HCL and Motorola in the past, and today you're the global CEO for an NGO. So, this should be an interesting story. So, tell us all about it.
Well, the story started almost 5.5 years back when Matthew Spacey actually invited me to I was approached to kind of join Magic Bus as a CEO. I really had not thought about working for a social sector. Although I did start two technology startups, one a social venture into healthcare, which you will learn failed miserably, and another for profit which did decently well. So when I got that call, I was myself not very sure, but then somebody told me he's a good guy, go meet him. You will enjoy meeting him. And I think, one thing led to the other. And over a period of time, I think, we started liking each other. In fact, I should share something very interesting with you, So when I was trying to make up my mind, and I'm sure, Magic Bus was trying to do the same for me, I requested that I go to, one of our sessions, which happens. So Magic Bus program is actually, socio-emotional learning. It is done through the medium of sports, and it happens in a playground. And so I really wanted to see what is it that, what is the difference that this program makes? What do they actually do? And I requested these guys and I said, please don't tell them who I am or what is the potential intended outcome. And so I went to a program which was in the outskirts of Mumbai. Long story short, I went there for a couple of hours, but I spent almost the entire day over there. So went to this program, liked it a lot, then came back to the outskirts of Thane. There's an office we had over there. I think it was Kalyan. Mm-hmm. And went over there, looked at, started meeting people, and people, came and started telling me about, what was good, what was bad, more about what was bad. And I kept listening to them. And then they said, finance mein hota hai, isme vaisa hota hai, ye hota hai. So anyway, I said, achha, theek hai, ye nahi kar sakte. Me being that, the corporate guy, how do we fix it? What is the solution? Then I was leaving. So all these guys were standing with their hands folded. And they'd probably get it, sir, please hame join kar lijiye. It was a very warm feeling, but at the same time, it was extremely unnerving also, right? And anyway, took me some more time, but finally I'm there, So
got it. Perfect. So we've heard a lot about how, Magic Bus has transformed ever since you joined them, whether it's been human resources with attrition and the culture there, or whether it was financially, you've turned it around. How did you go about this? What, tell us about that,
See, there was no magic wand per se, but I'll say that it is. So see, let me just contextualize this. See, NGO business is definitely far more complex than, what we do on the corporate side or for the for-profit side. Number one, there you have a customer who pays you for the services and product and you deliver it to that same customer. Here, you have two sets of customers. one customer who pays for it, who's the funder, and the second is the recipient of your services or the product, which is the beneficiary or the participant. And you have to kind of collect data at both the places, make sense of it, also kind of, you know, reach out to both of them in terms of enrolling or acquiring the funder and also, you know, the participant. So it's far more complex. It's also more complex because you don't have the resources which are there in the corporate side. So all that kind of really adds to kind of, you know, making it extremely, extremely difficult. And then the fact that, you know, you can't pay the normal salaries which the corporate, private corporate does, makes it difficult to attract right talent also. Well, when I came in, to be honest, I was overwhelmed, you know, in the first 10 days. And I was seriously thinking, am I at the right place? Should I kind of, you know, stay? Should I kind of leave? So I really had those questions for myself because the founder, fantastic guy, Matthew Spacey, he's also the founder of ClearTrip. He took me to, you know, meet some of the funders. And I guess, you know, it was really, really a very tough meeting with the funders. They didn't like a lot of elements of the program. And I realized, and over and above that, you know, our financial health was not all that great. And, you know, there were moments where we couldn't kind of, you know, we couldn't have paid the monthly salaries, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there was a lot of things which needed, which, you know, an organization which has suddenly grown without the systems, processes, without the automation has. So we had all those issues, you know, and it's a good problem to have, you know, because you've suddenly grown, which means that people believe in you and you've got something good. So the question was that, you know, where do you start? And well, it was really like, you know, a car moving at, you know, 80 or 100 kilometers and you having to change the wheels at the same time. Wow. So I thought that, you know, the most appropriate thing was to kind of, you know, do parallel processing, but at the same time, get people that, you know, you can rely on. And I think that's the single most important element, you know, in any organization. And I started by, you know, getting in some fresh blood. There were some really good people who were there. And we got people, both the best of the people that we could at that point in time from the social sector and from the for-profit world. And I was very lucky that, you know, we got 2-3 really exceptional talent, you know. And along, I think the whole team kind of worked. And we could kind of, you know, put things in place. We've started with, you know, see, you should understand that, see, even in a for-corporate world where you have the resources, you cannot implement all your automation at one time, your ERP, HRMS, CRM, your field mobility. We went for everything together. And I must give it to the team in Magic Bus that they had the zeal, they wanted to prove themselves, they wanted to do it, and they kind of, you know, they went through this massive transformation. And it has not been easy, you know. They've been very, very challenging. It's been a roller coaster ride. They've been very challenging times and moments of doubt. But I think at the end, we came out, you know, really, really strong. We built a good, healthy corpus. We've got a good, solid financial systems and processes. We've rolled out technology. In fact, I joke, you know, with my team that we are probably now one of the most automated Indian NGOs, you know. And again, I should kind of, you know, share with you that, see, our data on the field side used to take around 90 to 120 days to come to the head office, to the senior leadership team, because it was all manual. And there were lots of, the data was not clean. So you could, if there was something which was going wrong, there was nothing that you could do. So we got an automation, now we have it real time, and, you know, this history. Again, I think to add to our woes worth, the team, although very good, but my senses was not really aligned. And these people are very passionate. And, you know, if you can align them, you get fantastic results. But if you are not able to do that, I think, you know, it can be quite detrimental for the organization. So case in point, our employee net promoter scores, I suppose all of you know, but let me just kind of just tell you, employee net promoter score is like your customer net promoter score, where it tells you how many employees are going to recommend your organization as a place to work with their friends and relatives. Okay. And here, you know, on a scale of 5, typically the highest, which is the 5, which is strongly agree, that is the only score which is taken. So it's a very stringent process. Bain and Company set this up for us. It's done anonymously. But so just before I joined, we do this on an annual basis. So our scores were minus 35, which meant that none of our employees would have recommended Magic Bus as a place to work. From there on, despite the massive, I think, you know, changes we've made in the leadership team, in the financial processes, overall systems, bringing in technology, and a whole lot of, you know, other stuff that we've done. The team's been rock solid. And our scores kept improving despite transformation. And see, you understand that because you're coming from the HR context, that whenever there's transformation, your morale, your NPS scores do dip. But here, we kept on moving. And last year when we did this, you know, so we found that we were at a plus 56. And for me, as a CEO, this is far more gratifying than, you know, any great funder deal or, you know, doing anything else. You know, you start with your employees. Your employees are the single most important element of the organization. If you have them, your 80%, I would say, of your battle is won. Then I think, you know, whatever you do, your products, your offerings, your service, your programs, everything will have probably a good, strong result. So I think that's been the journey. Very, very happy that, you know, and it personally, it's been a fantastic learning for me. I think I've learned much, much more than I learned on the other side. And hopefully, I feel I'm personally a much, much better person than what I used to be. I'm saying both from a personal and professional angle, because, you know, you don't handle such large organizations where, you know, you have to make such massive changes and kind of, you know, carry the team with you and manage that, you know. So I, at least I have not done that before.
Right. Got it. But with regards to this automation that you sort of spearheaded at the organization, how long did it take for you to start seeing results?
Well, good question. See, it took us a lot of time. So one was that, you know, I think when we were implementing ERP, we had a lot of challenges because, you know, you have to have good input to get good output. We didn't have clean data. So it took us probably, you know, I think when we started, if you ask me, you know, once we had the right team and we started, it probably took us, you know, a year and a half to kind of implement it. We could have done it in a shorter time if we had some platform to build on. The bigger part is, you know, see, we are there for our impact, the change that we bring in the adolescents and the young people that we work with. So there we had to strengthen our program, and we brought in automation over there. And let me actually share this with you. Very interesting fact. So see, the sector is full of passionate people. And when we started bringing in technology, they thought this new CEO is coming and this guy doesn't trust us, you know. That's the reason he's trying to track us. So there were trust issues. They thought that, you know, some of the people, see, in any organization you have, you know, I would say 65% of the people are good, you know. There are 15% who are the kind of leaders whom everybody follows. I think there's another, you know, I would say 60-65% who are kind of, you know, the followers. There is a small percentage, which I would say, which is, you know, are the people whom you need to work with, either, you know, upskill, change them, or you need to decide, you know, what is best, you know, counsel them and get them to be part of the team. So we had those typical same challenges. And when we started implementing our field mobility called OSS, our team said that, don't you trust us? Why are you rolling out technology and what you're doing? So, I thought about it. And, you know, as a new employee into the organization, as a new CEO, you also want to be on the right side of the people. You don't want to be kind of stepping on their toes too much, right? Till you yourself kind of, you know, are established. So I thought about it. What was the best way to do that? And what should be, you know, is there something that, you know, we do in our personal lives which I could kind of relate to and kind of, you know, explain to the people? Because the intent was very good, very noble. It was not a trust issue. It was about efficiency. It was about a strong delivery. And we are all, you know, parents. We have children in our house. And we all trust our children. But don't we have oversight over them? Don't we guide them? Don't we tell them, you know, what needs to be done? And right. I told them that, see, most of the people who work with us on the field are these, you know, first time they've got into a job. They're 18 to 22 to 23 years old, you know, almost, I would say, 70% of our field staff. And I told them that, you know, you guys, see, it is our duty to see that, you know, you learn something over here so that you can make a good career. You work in a disciplined way. You also are able to deliver something which you are proud of. And I guess, you know, I think that and, you know, all the other change management stuff that we did, I think did kind of, and people saw the benefit, you know, they were saving time. There was no reduplication of data. It was, you know, online, we could take correctives. So I think, you know, I think everything put together, well, I think we did it.
That's great. Now, I've been told that you have these four mantras, right? So what are these four mantras? Would you like to share it with our listeners, please?
Well, I think, you know, this is, I call it a secret, but it's not a secret any longer. This is something which has helped me immensely and kept me in good stead. And so I would say that, you know, since it's helped me, I feel it would help others. So first one is attitude of gratitude. So when we are looking at a person, we are always looking at a person who has the right attitude, culturally can fit it into MagicBus. And we are very diligent about it. And we might have a person, you know, who might be slightly probably lower in the skill sets or, you know, the domain knowledge. But if the attitude is right, we know that the person will pick up. He or she would pick up and they would kind of, you know, settle in really, really well. And I think, you know, and I think we will get our ROI on that particular person. The second thing is also that we look at is, does the person thankful about what we have? You know, we have to be thankful about everything around us, you know, our family, our friends, our colleague, our work, the food on the table, etc. So if you have this attitude of gratitude, I think, you know, these people would, my sense is, would do well, or they would fit into any situation really well and come out the best. The second one is forgive and forget. And as leaders, you know, sometimes we do wrong things, and, you know, sometimes, you know, people who are working with us also could not be, you know, working at the 100%. So we should never carry anything, you know, which does not work, or, you know. So it's like baggage, you know, you're carrying something, then you're never able to kind of, you know, build a good, healthy relationship. People will not trust you. And the worst part is that, you know, the poor person who's part of your team will never be able to perform and be comfortable with you around. So I think it's really good to kind of, you know, somebody's made a mistake, forget it, move on.
Okay.
The third one, I think, is really important, is about teamwork. And why I say that is that, see, we spend more than 50% of our waking hours working. So, you know, 9, 10, 12 hours or whatever it is. And since, you know, it's such an important part of our life, I think we need to kind of, you know, get that right. And it starts with, you know, loving or liking what you are doing. If you don't like it, there is no way that you can kind of, you know, do well on your job. So you have to love what you're doing. And if you're not, then please fall in love with what you're doing. Also, you know, when you get into a team, you should be able to bring energy into the team. You should kind of, you know, give, it's not that, you know, one stands out like, you know, a shining star amongst that team. I think we have to make the team successful. We have to see that, you know, people enjoy working with you. People, if they have something, they come back to you and ask you for help. You're approachable. You are, the best example, when people ask me, Jen, which animal represents you? So I think of myself as a deer, you know, and the reason is the deer is resilient, tenacious, but also nobody's scared of the deer. You know, it's very approachable, you know, you're very comfortable reaching out. And I think the good part is that, you know, it also lets you know problems far well in advance so that you can kind of act on them. People are not scared to come to you. And also, you know, the good news anyway travels to you as it is. So it's the bad news, we should come to you. So that's the third one. And the fourth one, and I think this is even more important in today's context. See, we all talk about, you know, EQ and IQ, but I think the most important part is the SQ, which is a survival quotient. It is the ability to kind of fall and bounce back. And today with COVID, I think very, very important. I think, you know, we're all going through our own ups and downs, and it really helps kind of, you know, get back quickly on our feet and start with our lives. Just pick ourselves up.
All right. Talking about COVID, you know, obviously 2020 was, I mean, it wasn't exactly the best of years, but how did you as an NGO, you know, adapt to it? Now, corporates, I've spoken to founders, I've spoken to HRs, all of them said, ki, you know, their 5-year plans went out the window. How was it with NGOs? And I'm talking about NGOs across the country.
To say the least, it has been tough. What we understand is a lot of NGOs, probably 60% of them, have had to actually downsize or kind of, you know, wind up their operations. And even for a large NGO or institutionalized NGO for us, it has been tough. In fact, last March, I think 17th was the lockdown, and probably it's now almost, you know, 1 year, 3 or 4 months now. So when they announced, you know, the lockdown, we were in a pretty good, in the sense, you know, we've been kind of ramping our operations, we've been scaling up, and we've been bringing a lot of technology to, you know, improve on the impact or deepen the impact. And we thought that we were in a really, really good position, and, you know, kind of with all engines firing, we done some good round of new fundraising, which would have actually helped us grow by almost 30-40%. And as soon as COVID came in, we found that almost 35-40% of our funding had kind of, you know, moved into Prime Minister Care and other such, you know, things where it was very much required. And then, you know, you have a fixed running cost, and then you have to run your programs, you have to keep your people safe. So it was absolute, I would say it was something that, at least, you know, frankly speaking, none of us have faced before, right? And we came out with a business continuity plan. We came out with a 15-day business continuity plan, thinking that our 1st of April will be back, or, you know, beginning April will be back to work. And, well, I think, you know, we all know that history, that, you know, what we made was rubbish, and, you know, we just had to junk it. Then we made a evolving business continuity plan. And I think that really held us in good stead. We said, number one, we will not you know, cut jobs. You know, we are one family. We need to stay together. We need to take the pain together. And what we did was, we said that we will all, so 70% of our people on the field, like I told you, are, you know, entry level, and, you know, they have low salary. So we said we will not touch them. But we said that, you know, people above a certain salary will take a cascading amount of, so basically the higher the level, the higher amount of cut, you know, and the top person takes the maximum cut. So we did that, and we were able to kind of, you know, see that we did not have to let go of anyone. And when we had to kind of, you know, we decided that we'll roll this back if we were financially sound, and, you know, we had so much of money in our kind of corpus, etc., then we will roll this back, and we will roll this back in the reverse, this thing, you know, so that the lower people first get the salaries back, and then the top people, right? So, but it didn't come to that. I think, you know, probably by October, November, we saw that, you know, whatever we'd kind of decided on, we were on those goals, or probably ahead of them. We'd done some intelligent cost savings, renegotiating rentals, looking at, you know, local conveyance coming down, moving the program virtual. So I think, you know, a lot of stuff, which and the technology helped us kind of, you know, very quickly with a lot of agility, move in and pivot to, you know, new things that we wanted to do. One was to stay relevant and to also keep our community safe. So we were lucky that, you know, it did not affect us that much. There was also a silver lining, you know. See, there was all of us think that, you know, we want to do blended learning, we want to go virtual, we want to use technology. But, you know, till you are really forced to do that, you never get to do that. So I think what we did in this short 1.5 years is probably what would have taken us maybe 5 to 10 years to kind of learn and do. So I think there's been a tremendous amount of learning, you know, and I think there's a lot of it which will stay even post-COVID.
Correct. And with regards to technology adoption, I think this whole thing has been one of the silver linings during the pandemic, right? A lot of companies either experiment and are, you know, even today experimenting with either remote work or hybrid work, with, you know, meetings that are virtual and a lot of other stuff. I think the adoption of technology was accelerated over the last year, right? And of course, when you joined Magic Bus, you already went in that direction. You started getting a lot of technology on board and automating a lot of things. So it must not have been that difficult, you know, considering that you'd already adopted technology. And for an NGO, like you said, you're probably the most technologically equipped NGO probably anywhere in the country, right? So it must not have been that difficult.
Well, I think, you know, we probably kind of overplay that. I'm sure there are others, but it's good to kind of, you know, kind of pat yourself on the back. So probably we are doing a little bit of that. but yes, I think we would be amongst one of the more, I think, you know, technology-enabled NGOs. So I think, you know, it was definitely very helpful. First thing we did was we very quickly, as soon as this kind of, you know, there was a lockdown, we realized that, you know, if this is not going to be open, things are not going to open up for some time. We did a survey, again, you know, using one of the applications that we have. And we quickly found out that on the, so we did a livelihood program, which is physical in the classroom, where these people from marginalized communities come, we skill them, we get them into sustainable jobs. But we did a survey and we found out that almost 70-75% of the young people or youth in urban, peri-urban places had mobile smartphones. So that gave us the idea. The team immediately started, you know, delivering the programs virtually. And we were very lucky that, you know, there is a startup, a really great, fascinating startup called Class Plus. And the founder of that, you know, kind of got in touch with us. And he says, I'm going to roll out this platform free of cost for you. And you please reach out to all your youth. And we have 15,000-20,000 youth, you know, across the country. And that was, you know, godsend. And we rolled out everything on their platform. And we didn't have to pay a single paisa. They put in a technical staff to support us. And it's been just fantastic, you know. So and we, during this time, we were able to still continue placing almost 70% of the people who were part of our program. And, you know, the most important part in COVID is that people have lost livelihoods. 70%, our survey showed that 70% of the people were at 25% of the salaries as compared to pre-COVID. So important thing is to put money in their pockets so that they can continue with their lives. And I think this was really, really big. And we are told, again, anecdotal, one of our large funders said that, you know, Magic Bus is the only NGO which has got its heads above water and also figured out what they want, what they should be doing. They're doing that, right? So which is good, I think, you know, to get these kind of, I think, you know, accolades from your funders is definitely very, very, very good, you know.
Okay. Now, Magic Bus is present in the US, UK, Nepal, Bangladesh, Myanmar. How difficult was it to establish, you know, the Magic Bus initiative or the foundation in these countries and to achieve whatever goals you want to do in the first place?
Short answer, very, very, very difficult. Very difficult. We are still struggling. Okay. To be honest, we are still struggling. See, we have fundraising offices in US, UK, Germany, Singapore, and obviously India. But no, we have programmatic offices in India, Bangladesh, okay, Nepal, Myanmar. Most of our programming that we do, actually more than 95% happens in India. The other programs are very small.
Okay.
And see, the big challenge has been that, you know, we are very good at raising money from Indians for India. We don't know how to raise money from, you know, other nationalities for other causes. And when we stepped in into some of these countries, we had kind of, you know, we oversimplified the whole funding scenario, and we thought that, you know, we would be able to get funds. And as a result, we had to, you know, interim, we had to close the Nepal program for lack of funds. And but I think, you know, we've stabilized the other two programs because we then very quickly kind of found funders who were happy to support us for multiple years. And now, as a strategy, we are saying that, you know, we will not go into a new geography until unless, you know, we've secured the funding for minimum 3 years.
Got it. And you have staff in these countries as well?
Yes, we do. So in Bangladesh, we have a partner who's running the program. So it's partner staff. And in Myanmar, we have our own staff. And in Nepal, we had our own staff. But as of now, the program is on hold.
Got it. Now, you know, that being said, I want to come to the most important bit. As an NGO, you have been recognized as a great place to work, right? Earlier on in our session, you did mention that you automated a lot of things. Do you think this automation of a lot of things might have helped in you getting this recognition? Because at the end of the day, a great place to work in, I mean, there's culture, there is a lot of other things that come into picture. Do you think technology sort of helped you with this at the same time?
See, I can't say that just technology helped us. It definitely did, but I don't think we can overplay the role of technology over here. I think, this is, you know, the great place to work is the gold standard in terms of, you know, the recognition. And I believe, you know, an organization culture resides in the hearts and the soul of its people. And so I think it's very important that, you know, at least the people are good, they are transparent, they are fair. And they're also, it's important that they're also perceived to be that, you know. And I spoke about those trust issues, you know, when you were introducing technology and, you know, people are thinking so many systems, processes, are we kind of going to become like a production line or something? So slowly, slowly people realize that, you know, the goals or our vision, our ambitions were the same. And probably this would kind of help them. So I think the first question is about trust. How do you build trust within the people? Mm-hmm. The other thing is, if you're a genuinely good person, then I think you actually genuinely care for the people, and the people do realize it and notice it, you know, end of the day. I think everything begins with that. That is the most important thing, that, you know, if you're clean, uncluttered, and, you know, not selfish about, you know, about your own agenda, I think it does make a difference. And we've been very, very careful, you know. In fact, we've really completely, you know, restructured our whole recruitment process. We've brought in a whole lot of rigor, you know. So, and the most important part, like I told you, was attitude. We also see the cultural fitment of the person. We want to see that, you know, anybody who's coming from the for-profit world is not coming with a chip on the shoulder, you know. They should not think that, you know, they are going to come and teach us something, because the fact is that, you know, after coming here, I have learned so much more that I am thankful that, you know, the sector actually, you know, gave me this opportunity. So we are looking for people who are coming with, you know, these kind of qualities, who will fit in easily, who are not coming here. Money is not their main motivation. And they want to do good and, you know, do something which is challenging. So then this is the right place.
Got it.
I don't think I've come to. So I think, you know, it's a combination of, you know, trust. It's a combination of, you know, the good leadership teams and having the right, you know, kind of people coming into the organization. It's a question of, you know, communicating with them continuously and telling them what you're doing and aligning the people. We've taken lots of it. And see, we have a really good HR, our HR director, Monica. She's fabulous, you know. And she does a whole lot of, you know, sometimes, you know, award ceremonies, celebrating small wins, et cetera, with the people, which drives the morale up. There's recognition, there are wow cards. And so there's a whole lot of stuff which keeps the energy really high, you know. It's not possible to, you know, always work at 100%. And we do understand that, you know, people will, you know, kind of, it'll go down, it'll come up. So we try and see that, you know, there are things which we continuously keep doing in terms of, you know, keeping the morale high. And so celebrating stuff. And more importantly, we have a very strong communication cascade. I think that is a very, very important part. So it is not only top-down, but it is bottoms-up also. So we build a very strong cascade, which starts with the leadership team, then, you know, goes down into the regions, into the functions, and down absolutely up to the ground level. So I would say if you ask me, I think that's a very, very important critical factor in terms of, you know, telling the people what you're doing and why you're doing it and how is it going to benefit them, and transparently and honestly.
Got it. Are you using any communication platforms, or how are you able to enable this level of communication?
See, there is our technology platforms, which are there, you know, we follow a lot of these. So we have Service CTO, we have Comcare, we have our own OSS internal in-house built. So these do, and then we have an LMS platform. So these do kind of, you know, there is interaction which happens over there. But I don't think anything kind of beats, you know, your, and then the email and all, but and the social media which is there, but nothing beats, you know, plain and simple communication. So we have every Monday 10:30, we have the senior leadership team meeting, which is called GMC. Post which each of the people who are there will go back, and then whatever are the relevant elements of, you know, the discussions will cascade it down to their teams. So there's the RMC, there's the functional management committee. So they will roll it down to their teams, and, you know, and then it keeps going down till it reaches the intended recipient. And similarly, when we're doing, you know, upwards, Monica started a really great initiative called Employee Connect, you know, where she speaks, each of our HR people speak to, I think, one odd people whom they've not spoken to in the last 3 or 4 months. They'll pick up on random basis. And then they find out as to what is kind of going on, what is good, what is bad, what are they happy about, what is it that kind of, you know, is top of demand, what are the challenges they have. And then once in 2 months, she brings that whole list, and we don't put the names of the people who've given the feedback. She sits down with me, and then we pick up the ones which we need to really act on. So it's a continuous improvement process which we've kind of built, you know. And I think that so it's all these small things which kind of adds to, you know, the bigger picture.
Nice. Very interesting to learn that an NGO has gone to this extent, you know, to whether it's with regards to communication, adoption of technology, looking after their employees. Talking about that, how is attrition rates in the NGO world? Is it high? I mean, in general, I'm not just talking specific to Magic Bus.
I can kind of guess it. I'm not too sure as to what the attrition is. My sense is that, you know, it is different at different levels, actually, you know. So if you look at an NGO, you know, there are three parts to an NGO. The strategic and the leadership team. Then there are those managers, middle managers. And then there is this execution, which is the entry, which is bulk of the team in an implementation organization, I would say. And these are absolutely different kinds of people, you know, in an NGO, you know, with different skill sets, different kind of, you know, backgrounds. So this also brings, you know, a lot of complexity because these are very diverse backgrounds, you know, all three sets are coming from very different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so at the lower level, I think, you know, the attrition rate in any NGO, my guess is typically high because, you know, these are, you know, people, first-time job seekers, or people who are coming into the jobs for the first time and kind of learning, understanding, and the kind of backgrounds that they come from, you know, because we work with people from the community when we're going into a community. So they are from the same marginalized communities that we go and, you know, provide our programs to. So although, you know, we spend almost 7% of our, you know, budgets on training and enablement, but still, I think, you know, I think there's a lot more that can be done. So here the attrition rates are high for us. The middle management is a little lower and the senior leadership is even lower. So I guess the cascade would be the same, I think, across most of the NGOs is my sense.
Got it. And how have you been able to turn this around? Like, of course, before you joined, you did mention that, you know, there were a lot of the attrition rates at least were higher. How did you manage to, you know, turn this around?
See, we've not been able to turn it around. We're still working on it. And So, but I'll tell you, see, a couple of initiatives that we've taken, and this again goes with, you know, basically, you know, creating that alignment in the organization, the transparency, etc. So, and I'll just talk about one of them because there are multiple things that we've. So, one of the, I think, you know, our I would say our foremost or our top property is the PLP, which is the Performance Leadership Program. So, every year we pick up a certain set of people who are the top performers, and what we do is we bring them actually. So, we used to till before COVID, we used to physically bring them to, you know, a place. And there we used to kind of, you know, tell them what are the top challenges that the organization is facing. And we would put them into cross-functional teams, you know, we would divide them. And we would not identify a leader. And then we would tell them that, okay, this problem is yours. Now, you know, we would, and there would be a senior leader who would be a mentor, you know, two senior leaders who would be mentoring each of the teams. One, a functional head aligned to that function, and other not non-specialist who's not aligned to that function. The idea was that, you know, it brings in new ideas and also it brings in the domain expertise, you know, to the right mix of that. And then we kind of put these teams across geographies together and tell them that, you know, within, you know, certain timelines, they have to give the first kind of, they have to put, you know, the what is the overall ambition, what is the strategy, and how are they going to execute it, and what is the ROI going to be. And believe me that, you know, we've got people at the entry level on the field. We've got general managers participating in the same team. But it is such a wonderful, you know, the results are so good that, you know, we've implemented many of those results. You know, we've got them into a strategy. We've executed many of them. And it helps align the whole org. Because when these people go back to their geographies or their functions, they become your ambassadors of telling people why this is being done in the organization. So I think it is a win-win-win for us, you know. People get aligned, they act as ambassadors, and they're helping, you know, understand the problem, and they're being part of the solution, you know. That is most important. Otherwise, we would have had to push it down their throat.
Got it. Now, what are some of the strategies one should adopt to make their organizations a great place to work at? What would your advice be to our listeners especially?
See, there is no strategy per se, but I think, you know, there are lots of simple things which we have to kind of do, you know. So one is, I think the leadership should walk the talk. And I think the culture, trust starts with the top guy in the organization. And if he or she does not exemplify that, then I think, you know, I don't think it will percolate down. So I think that is, I think, very, very important. The Second thing is, I think having a very transparent communication, being honest. I'm not saying that, you share everything and about the organization. There's certain information which is confidential. But as far as possible, I think, be transparent. Open.
Yes.
Also, I think, this whole thing of meritocracy in terms of rewarding people who are really, really doing well, there should be some amount of internal healthy competition within the people. I think, that's recognizing talent. The fourth thing I would say is talent development. So we do a whole lot of, internal workshops and external workshops where we get people, again, from, diverse backgrounds. Like I spoke about the PLP. So we're doing one with Brispan, we're doing another with Dahlberg. So we get people into, these committees, So they're working with some of the best consultants in the world and trying to kind of, understand how they work, what is the thought process. And once they've learned that, we ask them to, pick up a project internally, which is important for the organization, and then, get the strategy and the execution plan right for that. So I think it's a lot of, getting them to feel involved, telling them this problem is yours. And I think most importantly, the right rewards. Rewarding them and celebrating, any wins which are there, and the last and the single most important is, I think, taking care of them. When COVID, the second wave happened, we got in, oxygen concentrators to wherever our population density was high. We our staff, in fact, when there were no oxygen cylinders available in Delhi, and two of our employees were actually running short of oxygen, were not getting oxygen beds, and I'm saying, really privileged people were not being able to get it. Our team found oxygen cylinders, kept these people safe, got it to them. So I think there is a strength in numbers, there is a strength in connection, there is a strength in the network that we have, large team. Okay. So we then rolled out a 8-point kind of a program which was taking care of. We set up a corpus that anybody was hospitalized, taking care of them, seeing that, the medical was kind of met, and no leave required. If you have COVID, you can recover and come back and join. A lot of these small things, I think, which kind of tell the employees that, yes, the organization does care. And, and then we are one family.
Got it. So, Jayant, now working in the NGO space, I don't know. I haven't really had any experience working with an NGO, but how are employees when it comes to, their mental health? I'm sure they must be, looking at things that affect them, their mental health. How have you been able to sort of keep their spirits up and deal with this? Now, I say this because of late, of course, we are addressing mental health. We are bringing it to the limelight. We are addressing how corporates should be taking care of their employees, especially, during these times. So in an NGO, how different are things?
So no doubt, I think it's a very, very important aspect that you brought out. In our own small way, what we've done is we've actually tied up with certain mental health and counseling organizations, and some paid, some free of cost. And we've rolled out these services to our people so that they can kind of, reach out, they can kind of take this help. And it is all done kind of, all kind of, absolutely confidential. So nothing comes out. We don't expect any data to come back to us, etc. And people can call and do that. And I think this is equally important on the for-profit and not-for-profit. I think everybody has their own challenges. But the fact that I think, a lot of our people kind of stay in very small houses and, they have to work from home or, operate from that. And then they have to, they look at everything which is going around them, At least we are in comfortable houses where, we're not running into each other all the time. We are not kind of, seeing things happening on the road, people falling off. These people see that and, they're working with communities, et cetera. So obviously the challenges are far more higher. And we realized that, this was an important aspect. And we've rolled out, mental health and counseling sessions for our employees. This was the part of that eight-point program, which we spoke about COVID. So this was one of the points too.
Got it. So, Jayant, before we wind up this episode, I just want to ask if there are any social media handles that you're on and, where our listeners can sort of connect with you, follow what Magic Bus does and keep up with all the good stuff that you're doing. If I'm not wrong, so far you have helped over 1 million children, right? I think about 1.5 million children.
That's right. That's right.
Great. So where can our listeners find you and, keep a tab on what Magic Bus is up to?
Okay, you can find me on LinkedIn at Jayant K. Rastogi, and my Twitter handle is at Jayant Rastogi, spelled as JayantRastogi. Thank you. Thank you, Junius.
Lovely, thanks, Jayant. Thanks so much for your time. Same here. Thanks so much. Take care. Stay safe.